come to Westboro in 1908. Mr. App, could you tell us where you lived in Westboro?
Originally lived at on West Main Street in a house now occupied by a family by the name of Johnson. Immediate neighbors were a family by the name of Bates.
What number Main Street?
I couldn't tell you that.
Okay.
I moved out of there when I was very young. Lived there about 2 years, and we moved to 26 Summer Street.
And how old were you then when you came to Westboro?
I was 6 years old.
In what year?
1908. 1902. That makes six, yes. So I had to move to Summer Street, 26 Summer Street. My father was in the trucking business, teamster business, they called it in them days, and had a quantity of horses. And we had a big house, and there was a big barn, and we had 8 or 10 pair of horses, teamsters, and
what did he use these teams for? What type of?
They used them for custom farm working, working in the woods, hauling gravel and so forth on the town highways at the time. The general teaming. They hauled freight from the freight houses to round to the different stores and factories. They hauled coal from the freight yards to the different factories. The general teaming.
And that's where the original term teamster comes
from.
That was
the real teamster came from.
I wondered if you would tell us about the effect of World War I in Westboro on your family and on the economy of the town.
Well, the effect on the family was my older brother was of World War I age, and he went in the service. And we lost several teamsters the same way, that part of the coast. And I turned 16 years old and that 1918, and I had to leave school to drive the trucks, which we had trucks at that time, also teams too. And
did many leave school? Many of the young men leave school?
A lot of them left school. A lot of them, 18 years old and older, they went in the service, most of them. But most of them left school to take jobs on the farms or various places around. And in the factories and so forth, because many of the factories run short of help because they had to change over from burning coal to wood and various other things of that nature, and it created a help shortage, there's no question about it. So,
were there ways that you were involved in the war effort itself or your family?
Only just that my brother went in the service, that's all. There was no other. We hauled war goods. I remember hauling wire from American Steel Wire to New Jersey and Pennsylvania and places like that. Nothing directly attached to it. And we had teams of horses hauling wood into the yards to be loaded onto the cars to go to Great Knights and other factories in Worcester and running around local. That we no longer could get coal. You couldn't get coal.
Was there a particular emblem or something left in the window if someone was in the army?
Yes, they had a emblem. I don't really remember what it looked like now. To tell you the truth.
Was it a star?
There was a they had two. They had a star. But that star, with the gold star, was when they had a death. But I think it was a blue star, and they used to put it in the window, the front window, so they knew that somebody from there was gone into the service, yes. I'm not exactly sure about that, but there was some form of an emblem of that nature, yeah.
Was there any rationing of food or clothing?
Yes.
Or shortages like that?
They had, I don't know as I remember any ration of clothing, because clothing wasn't a big item in them days. You wore the same thing all the time, almost. But they did have rationing of sugar and, of course, coal. Coal was fuel, particularly. And
how did they control rationing? Do you have any idea how?
They No, there was no real particular rationing. Government control is just you couldn't get it, that's all. It was an automatic rationing, that's all. There was no rationing such as you had in World War II, nothing like that.
What were the attitudes of the children and the young people towards the war, and was there a great uprising against, feeling against the Germans?
Well, of course, you get a hindsight on it. At the time, I don't know as I could tell you, there was a great hate for the Germans. And as you look back on it now, you see that the posters that they and so forth they had created this thing. I can remember one poster that showed a German with his spiked helmet and he had a Belgian baby hanging over the bayonet and those kind of things. So it created amongst the young people that form of tension. They hated the Germans, and people that were in the neighborhood, which we didn't have very many of them with German names, they really were put on one way or another. It was not a good situation.
It made it difficult for them.
Made it difficult for them, yes.
That's too bad.
Yes.
Mr. Aft, do you remember Armistice Day?
Yes, I remember it very, very well. But, first heard about it in the afternoon. And
the date?
November the 11th, 1918.
11th day of the...
11th day, because 11 o'clock in the morning, we didn't get the news until in the afternoon in town, and everybody turned out. Everybody came down to town square, and everybody hollering and yelling and having a great time. That carried on into the night. They had bonfires in the street, and just a general uprising of us all. It was like something else.
When the veterans came home, were there any provisions for them, or did they just get assumed into the...
No, they just assimilated back into the... I can remember the only thing that I remember that was anything out of the ordinary was a man by the name of Bud Fisher was the first one to come back. And at that time, there was a dance in the Grange Hall. And somebody got him, brought him up there, and put him up on the stage. I can remember just well as it was yesterday.
Was the Grange Hall in the same place?
The Grange Hall was in the same place.
Which
is
on Milk Street.
Yes. And but other than that, they just came home, and there wasn't any particular celebrations or anything of that nature.
Mr. App, could you tell us about the factories in Westboro and the working conditions in those factories?
We had a lot of factories in town. The main industry in then times was straw hat work and narrow fabrics, that's tape. We had a hat factory on Philip Street called the Westboro Hat Company. We had a tape factory, the Westboro Weave, on Milk Street, corner of Milk and Spring Street. And we had the J.S. Mason and Sons, that was a tape factory on Milk Street, also on the opposite corner of Milk and Spring Street. And we had the tannery, which tanned skins, on Beach Street. We had the shoe factory on Milk Street, now burned down, in one floor they made women's underwear. And in fact, several times in the years come since then, they've had various industries in there, but it was always known as the Gould Shoe Factory. And then we had, on where the Bay State parking lot is, we had the Trunk and Bag Company.
East Main Street?
Yes, on East Main Street. We had where the community house now stands. We had a factory that Haskell Lace Curtain Factory, and I think that about covers that.
Were a lot of the women and men in town involved in these factories?
Women, particularly. Now, most of them, the tape narrow fabrics were looms. They were run by looms. The women operated the looms. Some men did, but they also had men and boys working in there too. The shoe factories hired both men and women, and so did the hat factories. Of course, the hat factories were most of the operators were women, because they made they sewed the straw hats by a machine, sewing machines. And
could you tell us a little bit about the hat factory? You mentioned that your mother worked in it.
I wondered
exactly what kind of hats they made and what were the different jobs, for instance.
Well, they made women's straw hats, and they started out by what they call tipping. That was the little thing that started the hat in the middle. And they used to take these out to people in the, women used to sew them in the homes. They sew these hat tips in the homes, and they'd take the straw material out, the thread, and they had little sewing machines, and that's where they begin. Then they'd bring them back to the factory, and the women would sew the straw in. Now, of course, the straw was treated and
braided, was it?
And it was a braided straw that they got from, I don't know where it comes, some foreign countries. And they made a lot of different kind of hats, which I couldn't begin to tell you what the makes of them were. Then these hats, they would take them into another department, and they block them. And they used to make these blocks out of plaster of Paris. And one of the trades for the men was whittling. And they'd make these hat blocks, cast them out of plaster of Paris. And then these whittlers would shape them with tools, hand tools, they'd whittle them. And then they'd put them on these blocks, and they had these steam arrangements, so they'd steam the hat on the block, which gave it a permanent shape. And all, of course, they had the various, many, many different kinds of shapes. And from then on, they had the trimming department where they put the ribbons and so forth and so on, the binders and all this stuff, and then they shipped them in blocks, boxes. And every night there would be two or three double horse teams. I'd go over there to take them down, put them on the train to New York. Five, six nights a week.
They were sold mainly in New York?
Most of them went to New York.
Could you buy a Westboro hat in Westboro?
Buy a Westboro hat in Westboro, yeah.
You could. Yeah. Do you know the hours of the factories at all?
They used to work from, the women that sold in the factories, I think they could win most any time they wanted, because most of them were housewives. I know my mother would, who was a, if I may say so myself, was an excellent hat worker, considered one of the best.
Her name?
Louise.
Louisa. Louisa App.
Yeah. And she'd go in when she felt like it. Then they worked piecework. How much they made, I couldn't tell you.
They were paid by the piece?
They paid by so much a hat. They got paid by the dozen. Some types of hats would pay more than others because they were more difficult, see. But they got paid by the dozen. And they could go in most any time. Now, the maintenance department and the men at the whittlers and so forth and so on, they worked from 7 to 5.
Did they go home for lunch, do you know?
Everybody went. They either carried it in a bag or they went home for lunch. A lot of them would carry it in a bag because they want to play cards or something else during the noon hour. And many times when they're real busy in the winter time, they only have a half hour noon time. But, now let's see, but have I left anything out of there? I think not, as far as the hat trade is concerned.
Do you know anything about the shoe tray or the way shoes were made? Or?
Well, the shoe business had been, by the time I come along, it got pretty well, there was only one left, and that was, I can't think of the name of it now. Yes, I can tell. Walker Shoe was in the shoe factory there on Milk Street. But they would have got down to the point where they were only a little small industry. But previous to that, they had, and I don't remember it, previous to that, down on Brigham and Cottage Street, there was a big shoe factory there called Brigham Shoe Company, which employed many, many people. In fact, I might add, at this time, you know, the population of Westboro in them days was in the neighborhood of... I might add that the population of Westboro was around 4,500, most a stable population. But this would go up as high as 8,000, 8,500 during the winter. Because girls and women come in from Maine and Vermont, even as Nova Scotia, and stay here all winter and work in the hat shops.
Where would they live?
And they lived in the various hotels we had in town, see.
Which were they?
And there was, on top of the many rooming houses there was one, two, three hotels. Where now the Westboro News and the store that Daniel's Insurance Company's in, there was a hotel in there called the Westboro Hotel. It was a three-story thing.
That was on the South Street?
That was on Main Street.
Main Street.
Right across from the Bank Guarantee Bank, where it was on West Main Street. And it was a three-story hotel with rooms on the second and third floor. The first floor had a grocery store in it. And at my recollection, that was run by a concern called Flogs and Newcombs. Both of them citizens and long-time livers in the town of Westboro. The next hotel, I think it was on the corner of Brigham and South Street. There's now a gas station there. And that, I'm not sure what the name of that one was. That was a four-story, as I remember it, and it had nothing but rooms in it. There was nothing else but rooms. Directly behind it was what they used to call the Winchester Block. That was a three-story building. That was on South Street, facing South Street. That had a three-story building, and with a store downstairs and rooms up on the second and third floor. And down South Street, the next block down, was this, which is still standing, was used to call it the Union House. And that was another rooming house. At that time, there were stores on the first floor, but the second and third floor was rooms.
And these were mainly for the factory workers?
They were strictly rooming houses. Then if you come down South Street further, was the Central House, which is on the corner of Cottage Street and South Street, was still standing. And that was a hotel, and as far as I know, it was always known as the Central House. This was another one. That, as I remember it, used to rent mostly to men. As I remember it, there wasn't women in it. Now, when we moved from there down onto East Main Street, and almost opposite the end of High Street, adjacent to where the community building now stands, there was a hotel there called the Westboro Inn. And this was exactly what it says. It was when the town was wet, it had a bar on downstairs, but it had rooms upstairs. Now, there was many, many other places in town where they took in boarders and roomers. In fact, most of these places, they boarded and roomed.
So that they had their meals at these places?
Right. Most of them did, yes.
Included in a week's or a month's
Yeah, they played,
project.
But that was called board and room in them days. So these people came to Westboro, and they would go away in the spring because they didn't work on hats in the summertime.
You mentioned when Westboro was wet and when Westboro was dry. Could you tell us about Prohibition?
Well, before Prohibition, back, and if I don't get my dates mixed up, I think in Westboro at one time, and I think it stopped in 1910, Westboro was wet. And the only other town around here that was wet other than Worcester.
Wet meaning?
Wet meaning that they sold hard liquor or sold intoxicating beverages, I think you'd call it. And at that time, I don't remember, but this I remember from hearing so much talk about it. They had several bar rooms here in town, and people used to come in on the electric car from these surrounding towns and created such a situation that I think it was 1910, the town voted to go dry. And it was dry, of course, until, it was dry about, I think, until about 1914 or 15. Then they got liquor back again. But everybody had it around then. Hopkinton had it. I don't think Northwood did, but Marlboro had it. A lot of it. So we didn't have that situation. And then, of course, after World War One, right after World War One, we got Prohibition. That came in 1919. And then that shut down everything.
Were there any speakeasies?
And speakeasies, you would not believe.
You remember where any were?
God, yes, I could tell you hundreds of them. You want to know if the ones in Westboro? Well, let me see now. Let me start. You want to give names? Well, let me see now. The Central House was a, as far as I can remember, sold booze all the time. There was no stopping them. And they, then there was down in back of, then down in Cottage Street, there was one on Cottage Street. There was two on Elm Street that I can remember.
Were there passwords, or was it at
no,
all?
No, you. They knew you.
They knew you, they who you were, you. And they let you in.
Yeah.
Were they ever raided?
Yeah, they used to raid them. But I think it's history that they wasn't, that wasn't a successful situation. And then various places they had them in kitchens. And
people made their own?
Yeah, people, most of it was homemade. In fact, it was all homemade. They, there was occasionally one, there was one up on Milk Street, way up near the railroad track, that they used to make what they used to call bathroom gin. And he used to buy Belgian alcohol and mix it. And you could buy...
they mix it in the bathtub, or they just...
Well, at the risk of creating the impression that I might have been a drinking man, you could go there and he'd go into the bathroom and fill your pint bottle for you. Let's put it that way.
Dishing it out of the bathtub,
yeah,
or whatever.
But there was a lot of them around.
And then Prohibition officially went out...
In 35 or 36, I'm not too sure it went out. When it did, but anyway, it went out sometime in that area. That's a matter of history.
Right, it, but the way it affected Westboro is interesting.
But Westboro was no worse than any other town. Every town had them. I think Northboro, from my experience, I think Northboro had more speakeasy per capita than any town around anywhere. It really did, believe me.
I wondered now if we could talk a little bit about the railroad. You said that you, the railroad, where did it go through town?
Well, the railroad originally came through the square. This is before my time. I think in 1898 they changed that. That's a matter of history, too. And it came through and went up, which is now, well, we, the old timers, call it the railroad bed. But it goes up now in back of the arcade block and comes up on Milk Street in front of the fire station. It's now a one-way street. That originally was the old railroad bed. And it went, now sitting on top of the old railroad bed is the gas stations and where the Westboro Weave was and where the J.S. Mason was. And it came out back up on the main line. Now, they changed all that in the 1890-something or other. And they moved it where it is now, down on off, goes off East Main Street. And
where was the depot?
And the depot set, well, let me see. It would probably be, I would say it was on the corner of what is now Brigham Street and South Street on the east side. In there now is what is used to be the post office, mm-hmm. owned by Mrs. Hickox at the present time.
Was the depot a busy place?
The depot was a busy place. And down on Brigham Street was the railroad station, the freight station. And this town had tremendous railroad service. We had two locals a day come in here. That was one in the morning, it'd come going to Boston, and on the way back it'd stop in and drop off stuff, and the same thing happened in the afternoon. The local run between Worcester and Boston, and it stopped all along, of course, not only in Westboro but other towns too. And all the merchandise for the stores, all the coal that went in and out of this town went over that railroad. Now I can remember my father had two double teams 6 days a week, hauling nothing but merchandise and groceries to the factories and to the stores back in town. There was another outfit by the name of DeWolf that had teams doing the same thing. And every store almost had its own delivery teams that they used to haul these back and forth. Tremendous piece of operation, no question about it.
Do you know some of the products that would be shipped out of Westboro besides the hats? There was milk, I was told.
Oh, they're big. They had a big dairy area around here. And in back of what was I described as the railroad station, there was a platform when the local would come, they used to call the milk train. And the farmers would bring their milk in with their horses and jeans and plot them up on this platform, and that milk train come back in there and load on these cans of milk and take it to Boston or wherever it was going to go.
Early in the morning?
Yeah, and it was all lugged in 20 and 40 quart jugs, no tanks of any kind. But they would, farmers would be coming in, and, well, probably that local, if I remember, would get here at maybe 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. And then in the afternoon, he'd come back and dump off empty cans. So the farmer comes the next morning with his full cans. He takes some empty cans back with him, see?
And these were farmers from outlying towns?
These are farmers from around town here, around in the area here.
And did you take the train yourself?
Oh, yes. You want to go anywhere, you took these electric cars of train. We had tremendous electric car service here.
The trolleys?
You could go in four directions on the trolleys.
What directions, then?
You could go to Grafton, you could go to Northborough, you could go to Hopkinton, you could go to Marlborough. And they, we had the old Boston-Worcester high-speed line, which came across country from Boston to Worcester and run through, well, it crossed down on, it crossed East Main Street, crossed Lyman Street, and generally followed the old Boston-Worcester turnpike.
Now, the trolley depot, that was where?
Didn't have a trolley depot.
Well,
per se.
Various stops along the way.
They stopped almost any place. They would stop along the line for you, pick you up. Now the Boston Whistle Line was different. That was what they call interurban, and they had waiting stations like at Lyman Street and at Milk Street and all these various crossovers. And in between, they didn't stop for nobody, so nothing.
They went express.
Yes, and they called. They also hauled freight.
And the so trolleys.
The trolleys. The Worcester Consolidated hauled freight. And so did the Middlesex in Boston. They brought freight in here from for the stores. And
were the passengers in with the freight?
No. They had
it's separate.
They had a special car for that. Yeah.
Do you have any idea what the fare was in those days?
Yes. Used to go to Lake Chauncey for 5 cents. Used to go to Worcester for 15 cents. Go to Marlborough for 10 cents. Go to Northborough for 5 cents. You'd go to Hopkinton for 5 cents. And everything else was relative, I guess.
And they were fairly fast. They got you there.
Oh, yeah, get you there. Yes. They did get you there. I think the fare on the railroad to Worcester was 20 cents, as I remember.
The railroad would take how long? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, well, if you got one of the college, what used to be an express would only stop at Grafton, you'd get there in about 15 minutes, 20 minutes at the outside. And you go 15, 20 minutes to Framingham, but they would make several stops. They would stop at Southville, Carterville, and Ashland. So they'd create
the passenger section of the trains?
Yeah, the passenger trains generally were, I would estimate they'd seat close to 100 people. They were, most of them were cloth, kind of a velvet or a velour, and they had electric lights in them. And overhead they had racks where you could put your luggage up there. And then the very early ones that I remember, they had stoves that they used to heat them with, but just right around World War I they changed that and they heated them for steam from the engine. And they were comfortable and warm. And the stations were always kept comfortable and warm and clean. And they had on each train, they had a baggage car. So that's which they used to carry mail. That's the way they carried the mail all the time. And they'd throw off the bags of mail in Westport and pick up some more to take along with them. But comfortable, the cars were very comfortable.
Did men use these to commute to work at all?
They used to, everybody used them to work. They used to, as I remember it, right after World War I, when they'd go, a lot of people traveled to Boston to work in the offices down there. As I remember it, we had one went out of here at 6:20, going to Boston. One went out at 6:20. There was another one went out at 7:05. And there was another one went out at what they used to call the 8:05. Everybody knew about the 8:05 because those were the bankers and those individuals who didn't have to get to work till 9 o'clock.
The prosperous gentlemen.
That's right. And then there would be, I think there was one at 6:45 and another one about 7:30 that went to Worcester. And then these things would reverse at night. They come back, I can't remember now just the times they come back, but there would be three locals out of Boston and two from Worcester. And then at night, there was always what we used to call the midnight. They'd left Boston somewhere after 11 o'clock with the theater crowd, and they'd get, never knows on time because they had make so many stops. But that was of coming out of the theaters in Boston and so forth, and they'd drop everybody. They went to Worcester only, that's all.
The trip to Boston took how long?
The trip to Boston, if you got on what they call an express, which would start in Worcester and stop only in Westboro and Ashland and Framingham, and probably express clear through, you'd make that in about 45 minutes.
Better than today, practically.
Oh, yes, yeah. They them old steam trains, they really got around with them, and they were on time.
Were there dining cars also?
Not on the locals. Dining cars on the throughs, expresses. I used to work for a real motor car company and traveled back and forth to Michigan. And the dining cars, you just lived in a dining car, that's all. Yeah. And they were very nice. Food was good.
Yeah. Be nice if we could get that back.
Yes, it's too bad. It's nostalgic, but very practical, I think. Yeah.
I wondered if you would be able to give us some background on the Lyman School, perhaps?
Yes.
What you know about the boys there and the way it was run?
I had considerable contact with them in the later years, because which I'll go into later, but I'd like to talk about the Lyman School. I've become very upset when they did away with it, because it somebody had created a bad image for it, and in my estimation, having grown up in town and had contact with it through local schools competing in the football, baseball games like they used to. It was not really that bad. These boys came from all over the state, and most of them were there for minor infractions of the law. The boys from 12 years old and up was generally for stealing and stuff of that nature. And they brought them up there to the Lyman School, and they put them in cottages relative to their age and the seriousness of their crime. And the Lyman School operated on a merit system. When a boy went there, he didn't go there for 3 months or 4 months or a period of time. They put him there and put him on a merit system. And I understand his merits was arrived at because of his seriousness of his crime and his background and so forth. Of course, many of them are repeaters, but that should happen anyway. Now, these boys worked on the farm. They worked in the carpenter shop. They worked in the boiler room. They worked with the plumber. They worked in all the inn. They went to school. Every day they went to school the same as anybody else did. And they lived in these cottages, and each cottage was supervised by a master and a matron. Many of these masters and matrons had been there many, many years, and they were man and wife, mostly were man and wife teams. And these boys, they got them up in the morning, and when I first, they used to have them in uniform. They had them in state clothes. And but many of them came out of there, if you want to use the word, rehabilitated, that they use today, that they came out of there with a trade. I have in mind one particular one, and I'd like to tell you what I became. Later years, I became quite friendly with him, a little kid from Chelsea by the name of Johnny Murphy. And Johnny Murphy worked in the boiler room from the time he was a little bit of a shaver, and he kept running away, so they kept bringing him back. Later years, it was established why he ran away. When his merits was up, he'd run away. So they'd take his merits away from him, because he wanted to stay in that boiler room. And the last contact I had with him, he had got out of there, joined and had been in the Navy, and was a chief petty officer in the Navy the last time I heard anything from him. I was just telling that as a classic example. We had two young men come out of there from come to Westboro. I wouldn't mention their names because they have contacts in Westboro at this present time. But them two boys came out and became good, solid citizens of the town of Westboro, raised their families, and were a credit to the town, believe me.
How much contact did the boys have with the town?
Now, that they had considerable. We used to go up there and pick up teams and go up and play on football and play on baseball. Not that they were very good at it, because they didn't seem to get, they weren't them type of kids that got interested in athletics. But they had an outstanding band. And them, we used to bring that band down every Memorial Day, every holiday, every field day, and them kids come down, they had a real outstanding band, and they'd feed them and give them ice cream, and they had the little uniforms, and they were a real outstanding thing, and people really enjoyed them.
You remember the band leader?
The director was a man by the name of John Bryson. These kids, continue on that band a little bit. These kids, they got them out there every frequently. And they had their practice and so forth and so on. And it became an honor to get in that. If a kid, the merits were bad, he didn't get in the band, no matter how well he could play. And these things were important to him.
Lyman School Band was a reward.
It really was a reward to him. Because they not only went to Westboro, they'd go to Northboro, and they'd take them everywhere. All over God's creation, that is where they could. In them days, and they'd play around at these many celebrations and so forth, and the kids loved it.
Were there any negative reactions of the townspeople? Did parents warn children not to play?
It used to be the thing when you was a young child, if you did something wrong, you say, you do that again, I'm going to put you in the Lyman School. And it sure had a deterrent to those kids until they realized that you don't put people in the Lyman School by just telling them to go up there and play. They had a lot of adverse stuff about it. They used to, these kids, you know, they run away. They used to pay $5 to catch one.
A bounty.
A bounty. Well, they did the same thing with the patients in the state hospital. But these kids, you hear all kinds of things, but the kid didn't run away because they wanted to get away from the Lyman School. 90% of them run away because they want to go back to the Lyman School. That's hard to believe. But I had a great lot of contact with the people up there, and I'm telling you, them boys, they came out of there pretty good. It's too bad the thing's gone.
It was well run.
It certainly was. It was well run.
Did the boys ever go to public school in Westboro?
No.
They had their own schooling at the...
So you... Long, I think, at the last end of it, they did used to bring some of them down to the high school, but I think that was only just for a short space of time, and that was in recent years, I think. I'm not that sure about that. But they had their own teachers, their own school, all worked up there.
Would you be able to tell us about blacksmith shops in Westboro?
Blacksmith shop, yes. Westboro, like any other town, and I'm talking in the area around World War I and afterwards, had a tremendous amount of draft horses. Everything was done with horses. And so they had to have blacksmith shops. Now, a blacksmith in them days not only shod horses, he was called a wheelwright, he repaired wagons, he fixed wheels and buggies and all these other parts of things that were horse, but he fixed harnesses and so forth. And if we had two big blacksmith shops in town. One was on the corner of Cross and Ruggles Street, that would be on the southeast corner, and we had another one on Summer Street, which would be between what we used to call the old railroad bed and Summer Street, and adjacent to what used to be the trolley shop. Incidentally, the trolley shop, I forgot to tell you about that. But anyway, these blacksmith shops, they hired 3 or 4 blacksmiths, and we had another one, which was a small one, which was over in the area of on Union Street. And the blacksmith shop on Ruggles Street was owned by a man by the name of Henry Jackson. And that was our biggest one. And the one on Summer Street was owned by a man by the name of John Marcy, who at that time, previous to that, had worked for Jackson. And the one on Union Street was owned by a man by the name of Joe Brown. Now, these changed hands in the years afterwards, but They disappeared completely around in the early 20s. I would think probably the last one was John Marcy, who went out probably in the neighborhood of 28 or 29, somewhere in that neighborhood. But he was the last of them. But they...
Children watch the blacksmiths?
Children, oh yeah, their children were welcome. They used to go by there. In fact, I can remember when being a kid in the elementary school, that was one of the places they'd take you. You'd get the class out and take you down there, watch the blacksmith work. They were real geniuses, there's no question about it. How much you can appreciate them today, side of what you did in them days.
Yeah. All the handwork and the iron
rod.
A lot of the farmers would have their horses shod.
Oh, everybody had to bring their horses in there to have them shod, because you couldn't work horses without having them shod. And you see, you use different kinds of shoes on horses. In the summertime, they used what they call summer shoes. And they had what they had called dull corks. Now, a cork is a part of a shoe that digs into the road for a better... It's like a spike for it. In the wintertime, in kind of the ice, you had to put what they call winter shoes on. They take those shoes off, summer shoes off, but winter shoes. These had sharp spikes in them, or sharp corks, as they called them. Now, they had some kinds. They had some made in there. They had another kind that came along and used to screw them in, like you'd screw a bolt into a hole. These could be removed without taking the shoe off. And the farmers come in, of course. The farmers had to have their horses shod. And in fact, my father used to buy green horses. And it was quite a trick to get them green horses shod. Now, a green horse is a horse that's unbroken. And before you put them on the road, you had to have them shod, otherwise they'd ruin their feet. See? So we take them down, and John Massey used to have what they used to call a squeeze cage. You get a ruckus horse that you couldn't handle, they put him in a cage, and they used to squeeze the sides up on him so he couldn't kick. And they used to shoe him through the slats, see? But they were quite genius.
Then somebody would have to ride him or trade him after that.
Yeah, I trained many of them myself. Draft horses. It wasn't that complicated because you take one draft horse, green draft horse, and either put him with another one or put him between two that were already broken. And either way, you dragged him, one or the other.
Were there harness shops and stables?
Yes, we had, we had two stables in town. Those were livery stables. Of course, everybody that had horses had stables. But in the area where the junior high school is now, there was Everett Brown, had a big stable there. He rented out horses for funerals, weddings. Your salesman would come and hire a horse and a rig to go around to the different places. And down on Brigham Street, John Ford had one there, and he did the same thing. These were competitive. And you have funerals. They used to have these hacks, you know. Had the winter and summer hacks. In the wintertime, they were on runners.
A hack is to use?
A hack would be the man sit up in the front and drove it, and the people got inside. It was an enclosed thing, something like a sedan chair. And that's where you went to the churches. You went to the funeral. Sundays, a lot of people would hire one to go to church on a bad day.
A carriage, in a way?
Carriage, yes. And they used to hire kids. I've drove a hack many, many, many times. And they'd come and you'd think nothing of hiring a rig to go, salesman come to Westboro on the train, you'd think nothing of hiring a rig to go to Hopkinton or Northboro or other places to do his business. You'd go on all day with a rig, sometimes a couple of days. But
horse and carriages around the streets quite a bit.
That's right. Everybody had horse and carriages. In fact, the main street, probably there's pictures of it available, where they had these hitching posts. And there used to be a metal post with a horse's head on it, with a ring where you tied them up there.
Do you remember the first cars in Westboro?
The first car I ever saw was in 1909, I think. And it was on West Main Street. Well, we lived in West Main Street. We only lived there 2 years, so it'd have to be between 1908 and 1909. So I'd call it 1909, and of course it was a gravel road, and the first car that I ever remember came up through there was a Rambler, one cylinder Rambler, and I can remember there was a little mud in the street, and they couldn't make the hill. There was two men and two women in it, and the two women and the man got out and pushed it up over the hill, And, of course, after that, why, various, you see a lot of various kinds, but by World War One, then they had come along to the point where they were that much better. And, of course, the war always does those things. Then we began it. By that time, we had trucks. Not good trucks, but my father had the first truck he bought was a 1916 Rio. And we had, after that, he bought a Packard, a 1917 Packard, Cavova thing.
And, with his hand crank?
And these are all hand cranks. And they had acetylene lights, gas lights. And the automobile came in fast. And the Model T came in, of course, 1914, and that really set the pace.
Were there any troubles between the horses and the cars?
The horses were afraid of everything. Peculiar thing, horses aren't afraid of anything today. I remember it took you a long time to get horses used to working in the freight yards with them engines. You're scared to death of them. And in fact, we had several of them run away, but